Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
Je suis Thomas Freno, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
So thank you to Thomas Freno, who introduced the Tennis Podcast, one of our Kickstarter backers who've helped keep the show going all year long, or certainly into March. Let's see how we go in the rest of the 8 months, shall we, before I get too carried away. But we've got another edition of the Tennis Podcast here for you right now, following Indian Wells, following two magnificent finals. Myself, David Law, alongside, or not alongside, but on the same show as Catherine Whittaker, who's how many miles away is Indian Wells?
Digitally alongside, David. I think it's about 6,000, but by the miracle of technology, it is zero.
Isn't that amazing? Imagine if 30 years ago, when you were, well, barely born, somebody had said we would be able to do this. Amazing. Anyway, so I digress. The tennis world has had its eyes on those two incredible finals in Indian Wells. You've been presenting the men's event for Prime Video, Catherine. Let's start, though, with the women's event, because although the men's final was a corker, I think the women's final was arguably even better. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, not much in it, I don't think. They were both sensational. Bianca Andreescu, 6-4 in the third, receiving treatment on her right shoulder throughout the third set. She was cramping in her semi-final against Elina Svitolina. She is, can we just sort of replay the podcast we did a year ago about Naomi Osaka and just edit in the words Bianca Andreescu, but possibly
really?
Even more so.
That sort of level?
Possibly with even more superlatives, because she's just got this extraordinary variety in her game. She blew me away. You quoted me on Twitter as every match I saw her play, you flagged her up to me after her first or second match, it was, when she absolutely obliterated Stephanie Vergara, who had herself obliterated Sloane Stephens the round before. So I started watching her progress eagerly, and I was kept having these, well, I don't understand, how has she ever lost a tennis match moments? Why is she, what is she, what was she, 128 in the world? 152, sorry, she's now up to 24. 152 she was. And I know she's only 18 and these are early days, but I don't know how she has not been, more on our radar. I know the Auckland final, she's not out of nowhere, but equally she's even more out of nowhere, significantly more out of nowhere than Osaka was when she won this title last year.
Usually they have one big win, don't they, or one big run, and then they disappear for a bit and they may never come back. You know, we've seen players that have had one special week and then got found out or just played way above themselves, or at the very least
she's coming back, David.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, after the Auckland final, it wouldn't have been surprising if we didn't really hear her name until about Cincinnati or something. And as you said, 152 in the world at the start of the year. In a couple of months, she's got to 24 in the world. And she had to win seven matches to reach that final in Auckland to get through qualifying. She's had to win seven matches in order to win this title, because she didn't get a bye through the first round in in Indian Wells. And when you look at the players she's beaten over the course of those two tournaments, Venus Williams, Caroline Wozniacki, this week Irina Camelia-Bego in the first round, Dominika Sibulkova in the second round, Wang Chang, Garbiñe Muguruza, who she beat 6-love, 6-1, Elina Svitolina and Angelique Kerber. She's basically beaten, okay, maybe Serena Williams and Osaka aside, she's beaten the best that the WTA circuit has to offer at the age of 18. And she's done it in a manner that is different to the vast majority, if not all, of the players that are out there, because there are bits of her, of all those sort of players in her, but there's nobody who's quite got that package that she's got. Now, that's not to say that she will sweep all before her and be better than Osaka and better than all the others. It all has to come together, especially with a game as varied as hers. So much has to, it all has to be right. But goodness me, in terms of just options, she's got a limitless repertoire and limitless potential.
Yeah, she's like a sort of tennis Frankenstein, but in a good way, isn't she? It's like someone has constructed borrowed bits, limbs and aspects of all the best people and put them together in one Bianca Andreescu, complete with scrunchie on arm. Which everyone seems to be going nuts about. I mean, I think I walked around for the first 20, well, probably more years of my life with a scrunchie on my arm.
Why?
Or at least a hair tie. You can't be without a hair tie. But she didn't play
around your arm.
She didn't play the final with a scrunchie on her arm, did she?
Why do you have one around your arm?
Well, I mean, at least around your wrist, because it's just a very accessible, practical place to have it.
Is it?
What if you have a hair disaster, David? Anyway, yeah, she's like a she's an amalgam of all the best things in tennis. It's unbelievable, and it just feels like this sort of exciting tennis youth arms race. You know, Naomi Osaka. Well, you know, well, you could go back a while, couldn't you? Sloane Stephens comes along, Naomi Osaka comes along, and Bianca Andreescu comes along. And they just keep getting younger and better. And it feels like the women's tennis globe world is turning very, very quickly at the moment. Sort of the advancements are huge. I don't know. Does it feel like that to you?
I certainly feel this is a wave of players. And they feel like they're coming along more dramatically than they are on the men's side. But then you don't have that group of three in their way in the same way that you do on the men's side. But the manner in which she's done it, to do it in 2 to 3 months, and the manner obviously the way that Osaka has won the last two Grand Slams, and then you've got Arina Sabalenka, and we had that one standout win for Amanda Anisimova at the Australian Open when she beat Sabalenka. But this woman has backed it up now. And she's done it over multiple matches. That's what really gets you. And she's done it against all these different types of opponents. It's like somebody has given Daria Kasatkina big power and said, "Go on, have a go with this rocket launcher. You know, see what you can do with that as a forehand and as a serve." And she also has just this love of the battle. Love of the moment, clearly a thirst for competition and the game and the excitement of it all. And there was that wonderful moment where she asked for, she was clearly flagging and Grad Matt actually tweeted, you know, she's tired and the last thing you want to be doing when you're tired is playing Angelique Kerber. And I thought, well, absolutely right. But along came her coach and I don't want to give all the credit to her coach, who obviously did a good job in the moment. But the main thing that I think he did was keep quiet and let her talk. Sylvain Bruneau, this was. And she said to him, and you heard this quite clearly, she said midway through the third set, when I think she was a breakdown, 3-2 and a breakdown, she said, "I want this so bad." And I thought, what a lovely thing to say. Not "I'm scared" or I'm not going to win or something like that. I just made it very clear what it meant to her, and he then just tried to get her to channel that, and she went and won the next three games and ended up winning the title. And she did so whilst losing out on match points, because on the first of, I think she had four match points, and on the first of them she hit a forehand cross court, the likes of which had been going for a winner all week long. Kerber, being the incredible defensive player that she is, was able to get to it, lob it onto the baseline, win the point and extend it for another game and a half. And the fact that Andreescu still ended up winning from there, I think, is a huge achievement, mentally as well as all the rest of the things in her game. And she got plaudits all over the world. The Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, was in touch to give his congratulations. All the best players in the world were sending their congratulations as well. I mean, it just felt like a big moment. I mean, I think you're right. I think it was a little reminiscent of Osaka winning the title last year in that way. But it's just that we hadn't, with her, we'd had some warning signs of her talent for a longer period. I think you'd flagged up Osaka a good year and a half earlier than that.
Yeah, as I say, even more out of the blue. And I should also point out, I don't know if you agree, but Angelique Kerber, her performance in the semi-finals against Belinda Bencic, another fantastic match. I mean, the women's tournament, from, there were so few disappointing big matches, you know. That was as good as I've ever seen Angelique Kerber play. I really mean that. I know she's won three Grand Slams, but that performance against Bencic took my breath away. She was unreal, because Bencic, you know, needed some beating. What a run she's on. As far as I'm concerned, she's still on that run, because it took the absolute very best of a three-time Grand Slam champion to beat her in Indian Wells. So for Andreescu to beat Kerber in that form, it's mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling. Mm. And also, you know, the different types of players that she beat. You know, she blew Muguruza off the court, but then she had to beat Elena Svitolina, a completely different type of player, could not be more different. And she figured it out. You know, she figured it out in the way that we've seen Osaka do. And goodness me, she is quite something. She really is. And she has this incredible balance about her physique. Obviously, she looks incredibly strong for an 18-year-old, but she looks balanced. You know what I mean? I guess the strength in her legs really helps with that. But yeah, she's got everything, David. She really does.
She was asked in an interview by Courtney Nguyen on the WTA Insider, which tried to get to the bottom of how she ended up being the sort of player that she is, because it's usually you can kind of see the origins of a player, the way they play. You can think, oh, that player has trained in Barcelona, or that player has come from the Bolotieri Academy, or something like that. And she hasn't gone that sort of route. She was born in Canada. She then moved to Romania, which is where her parents are originally from, or at least her ancestry is. And she went over there, picked up the racket for the first time over there, then came back to Canada and has had her developmental years in Canada. But she said that she would get bored hitting the same shot over and over again when she was a kid. So as a result of that, she changes the rhythm, or she has traditionally changed the rhythm of rallies just to keep herself interested. And I find that fascinating. And to hear her talk about her approach to the sport and the weapons that she likes to use, it's not just, oh, I've got a big forehand, I've got to bring that into play, or I've got to serve well. She's talking about a toolbox. You know, she's actually referring to it in those words, and that her goal is to keep her opponents guessing and off balance. And I was just thinking of all the players that would have been music to the ears of, like Andy Murray and John McEnroe. You can just imagine them high-fiving people in the room that don't know what on earth's the big deal, you know, because that's their kind of tennis. And it's just really uplifting, I find, that you have her and you have Osaka and you have Bencic that are, I don't know, they've all got something. And they're all 22 and under. It's hard to believe that with Bencic sometimes, but it is so uplifting to think that that is the future and we've got that to look forward to.
And really uplifting to hear Andreescu talk about meditation and how prominent that is in her approach to the sport. And a few years ago, I was really not dismissive of meditation, but pretty certain that it wasn't for me, you know, far too wafty for me. But actually, I've found I'm not alone here. I know it's a very very now thing to say, but there is a lot in mindfulness, and it's not just for wafty yogi type people. I do yoga as well. I'm not slagging off yoga, but yeah, to hear an 18-year-old talk about meditation being a significant tool in her arsenal, and helping with her mental poise, and talking about creative visualization. I don't know about you, David, but that's not what my mind was doing when I was 18.
She's amazing. I was trying to get into the cinema to watch 18 films when I was 18. Failing.
Yeah, but hey, maybe more will try it, you know. I mean, I suppose Djokovic has talked quite a lot about it. I don't think I've ever heard him maybe he has, but Djokovic has talked about, he talks more about sort of spirituality, doesn't he, rather than specific sort of mental agility and mindfulness. But maybe more of them all,
but you
give it a go.
Well, you do see him go off into somewhere that he feels at peace with the world, don't you? And I mean, look, sometimes the pictures he takes and posts, you know that some of the locker room might be going, look at this, look what he's posted here. Well, hold on, he's the world number one, you know, and whatever anybody thinks of it, it works for him. And with Andreescu, I think it's incredible to hear an 18-year-old talking about meditation. I really do. I take my hat off to her for that, and for having the open mind for it and not being too cool for it. And in her words, I really want it, you know, and she really does. So it's going to be fascinating to see how she packages her schedule for the rest of the year. We've talked about Tsitsipas, that danger of just overloading yourself because of the excitement of it all. And look, we're all almost competing with our superlatives for this woman, because she is such an exciting young player. And she's going to have to be selective over what she listens to and what she doesn't, because it can go wrong, can't it? And she's, I hope that she can just be looked after in the right way. I don't want her to have the screens go up, because she's a lovely open interviewee. I wanted to talk and be herself and all the rest of it, but it's difficult not to get carried away.
Yeah, you can imagine the sponsors swarming, can't you? You can imagine the scenes.
Yeah, you can. But anyway, it was a wonderful tournament on the women's side, and a fantastic end result. I mean, even when we were getting excited about Andreescu a week ago, couldn't have ever imagined that she would end up actually winning the tournament, because that is such a succession of strides to take. Just one note as well on Martina Navratilova, who was on the BT Sport team, talking about that final. And I don't want to say she was critical of Kerber, but she did say that whenever it's tight like that, she feels in a big final, her first instinct is batten down the hatches, defence, don't let anything past, which is a weapon in itself, isn't it? And it makes players miss. But she didn't take that match away from Andreescu. She was kind of waiting for Andreescu to blow up.
I dare say there's something in that, and I'm not going to be disagreeing with Martina Navratilova, but she has won Grand Slam finals from those sorts of situations. So you can understand why she thinks, well, this is what works for me, this is what I do. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, she's absolutely right. Andreescu was the one to grab it by the scruff of the neck, rather than Angelique Kerber.
That's just not Martina's tennis, is it? Martina naturally gravitates towards the attacking player, because that's what she was, I would imagine.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Right then, so in the men's draw, a match you were taking a lot of notice of was Dominic Thiem's victory over Roger Federer in the final, which, I mean, seemed unlikely, didn't it, when Federer won the first set in 18 minutes, 6-3, and he was just taking it early and all over him. I mean, it was incredible, really, the way team managed to reel him back in. What was your reading on it as you were watching in the studio?
Well, there was a, because the women's final was so good and so long, there was a long delay on the scheduled start time for the men's final, and we were watching these warm-up shots come in of both of them, but I was paying particular attention to Dominic Thiem, and then we saw them get on the buggy and go to court, and all I could think was just how tense and nervous Dominic Thiem looked. Actually, his fitness trainer was doing this weird sort of exercise where he had one hand on either side of his chest and was sort of, it looked like sort of literally trying to loosen up his chest. Daniela Hantikova in our studio thought that, you know, that was a sign that he was really feeling the tension, and his fitness trainer was trying to sort of physically press the tension out of him. And so it proved, you know, in those first three games, it looked like, oh, goodness me, you know, he's just crumbling here. You know, you could almost see that his arm weighed twice as much as it usually did, and his movement didn't seem as nimble as usual, and it looked like it could have been a disastrous day for Dominic Thiem. So for me, that makes it all the more incredible that he pulled it back and he didn't panic, you know, and he said after the match that he felt in the zone the whole match, which I found really amazing. He obviously really didn't read too much into the fact that he was 3-love down, maybe even because of how nervous he was, sort of almost expected to make a slow start. And obviously just managed to reset in his mind after that first set and say, you know, okay, the match starts here. And by total contrast to Angelique Kerber, when Dominic Thiem's in a tight spot, he just hits the ball harder and harder. And it takes your breath away sometimes. And yeah, he was bludgeoning the ball, David, in that deciding set. And I think we were all sitting there waiting for him to not choke, but to certainly start feeling it, you know, because there were signs of that against Raonic in the previous round in the semi-final. He had a real wobble when he was in the lead in that deciding set. And it was only because Raonic was wobbling too that he was kind of let off the hook. But I don't know, he found something else in that final and in that deciding set. And for me, this is an enormous statement from Dominic Thiem.
He does get to a point, I think, in a match, in these big matches against the best players in the world, where he just thinks, forget this, I'm going to just have to go for it. And as you say, he gets into a let's see who can hit the ball hardest competition. And I think he can probably hit the ball just about as hard as anybody. And it was interesting watching Federer, because Thiem hits incredibly hard with both forehand and backhand. Federer was just trying to weather it by using his movement, staying up on the baseline and just deflect the ball back. And the timing of Federer was, I mean, it was a joy to watch in itself, watching him try to find ways to get into the net whilst under attack from this barrage of hitting. But you are always waiting, I think, for Thiem to miss, because it feels so low percentage. How is he going to keep making these shots when he's launching these extra sets low over the net some of the time, flat? It doesn't seem doable. But then you think back to Stan Wawrinka doing exactly that for 2.5 hours against Novak Djokovic to win the French Open. And that's what Thiem brings to the table. He did it against Nadal at the US Open, didn't he? And he so nearly beat him in five sets when he had that purple patch of big hitting. And here again, that's what happened. And it does seem like, increasingly with Federer, Federer tries to race out into victory and get the win almost before the guy is settled down at all. If they get their foothold now and they're playing really well, the sheer pace of shot can take Federer down. We've seen it now with John Millman, we've seen it with Stefanos Tsitsipas, we saw it again here, although I actually thought Federer played pretty well. I thought he was close.
Yeah, Federer played great, I thought, and I think that's why, in his own words, he wasn't too disappointed after the match. I really think there was a sort of resignation about him of, well, you know, I really played well against most guys, that would have been enough today. But, you know, Dominic Thiem just brought it, just absolutely brought it and seized it from his grasp. I'm sure if he hadn't already got number 100 in Dubai, that disappointment would likely have had slightly more edge to it. But yeah, I mean, Dominic Thiem has now beaten Roger Federer on a hard court, on a clay court, and on a grass court. That's quite something,
wow,
isn't it? Yeah.
That is, yeah.
Leads the head-to-head 3-2 and has beaten him on hard and grass. I find that amazing.
Yeah, and his first Masters 1000 isn't on clay. I mean, it's mightily impressive. And he also, those 2 points, wasn't he love 30 down when Federer hit those two drop shots? I can't exactly remember what the score was late on. He hit successive drop shots, Federer, and Thiem. And there weren't bad drop shots, I didn't think, but he found ways to get to the ball and divert them past Federer with just lovely hands. I mean, he really does have the most immaculate timing when he's playing well, Dominic Thiem. He's a joy to watch when he's on.
Has there ever been a greater contrast, David, between somebody's personality and their playing style than in Dominic Thiem? He is this completely gentle, unassuming character off the court and has not changed one bit since he, you know, came to prominence in tennis, and yet he's got this absolutely ferocious beast of a playing style. It's an incredible contrast.
And there's an extravagance to his stroke production as well, and he's anything but extravagant.
Exactly that, as Greg would say. And extravagant. Yeah. He's such a nice guy, and I think he gets too hard a rap for being boring or whatever, Dominic Thiem. He's not. He's just no frills. He's just a regular bloke that likes playing football and likes dogs. Obviously, I've got a soft spot. He's got a lovely chocolate Labrador. Or is it a black? No, he's got a Labrador anyway. But yeah, then he steps onto court and it's frills. It's nothing but frills.
Yeah. New coach, Nicolas Massou, the Olympic gold medalist of 2004. Which is an interesting development. I mean, that is recent.
The Olympics that Federer should have won. really. Well, that's how, certainly how Federer will see it.
It is interesting, though, isn't it, that he's gone this direction and Masu is in the audience there. And look, maybe that's the fine tune that he needs. I remember Masu as a player, different kind of player, but he needs a few little tweaks to his team because he's not getting the best out of his game, or he hasn't, in my opinion. And I do think there is a danger of him not fulfilling his potential without changes. And that's even off the back of this. This guy should be winning Grand Slams.
Yes, agreed. And my goodness me, what an advert for Nicolas Massou's coaching skills. He's only been with him 3 weeks. Massou was a clay courter that got his best results on hard, unexpectedly. You know, he'll always be remembered for that, for the Olympics. Didn't he win doubles gold as well that year?
He did, with Fernando Gonzalez, you're right.
Double gold medalist at the Olympics in Athens on hard courts. And he was considered a clay courter. So, an extraordinary advert for his coaching skills. I think in the particular case of Dominic Thiem, where he's been with Günter Breznik since he was a kid, and there's absolutely no question of him wanting to jettison Günter Breznik's coaching position at all. But a new voice, when you've had the same voice for that long, I can imagine a new voice is very, very powerful. And, you know, it's not even necessarily something that Daniela was saying a lot in the studio this week. It's not necessarily always about what they're saying. They could be saying the same thing that other people have told you. It's about the way they say it and making you listen and understand. And that is obviously working with Dominic Thiem, because there seemed to me, and I'm borrowing a bit from an analysis of those around me this fortnight that have a better technical understanding of the game than I do, it seems to me he's developed more astuteness tactically on a hard court. He was really varying his position on the return. Yes, sometimes he was standing 18 metres behind the baseline, but then he was also standing in quite a lot and really varying it sort of according to what was working and what the scoreline was. And he seems to be, learning how to use and adapt his game, particularly on this surface. And look, Indian Wells is a particularly well-suited place to do that, because he says it plays like a clay court. The only thing that's particularly different about it is that he can't slide. But in terms of the speed of the ball off the court and the bounciness of it, the bounciness of the court, it's very much like a clay court. So if he was going to make a hard court breakthrough anywhere, this was going to be the place. But I do think that match against Nadal at the US Open paved the way for this. I know he lost it, but it was such an enormous breakthrough for him on this surface. I really think that without what happened that day, we might not have seen what happened against Federer in the final.
And he'd had a rough old time at team this year. He'd had illness, he hadn't been able to compete, and then he had 11 days in Indian Wells to prepare, and look what it did for him. Now, Nadal, Catherine, we're a bit worried about him, aren't we? 39th meeting with Roger Federer was about to happen, and then it didn't because of the knee problems that Nadal had sustained in the previous round against Karen Khachanov. And he spoke quite at some length about the toll of hard courts in conversation with Chris Clary in the press conference afterwards, and talked about, I mean, it's not the first time that the sheer number of matches that players play on a hard court and the toll that it takes on the body, the jarring of the joints. And he was at pains to point out that, look, this isn't just about me. But if they change things, it won't affect my career. Now I'm too old. But it was almost a little melancholy hearing him talk about, you know, I see some of the old legends walking around on the circuit these days, and it's not nice to see, you know, that they're struggling to get up and down stairs and things like that. And you know that he was looking at himself in years to come. I don't know how I feel about the issue of hard courts, because it's always been like this. And I also do take the point that, hold on, Roger Federer's 37, you're 32, Rafa. everybody at the top at the moment is well into their 30s. That didn't used to happen years ago when there were fewer hardcore tournaments. So is it that bad? And should we not expect players to be struggling when they, you know, on these surfaces when they get older? I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, it hasn't always been like that. There used to be an awful lot more, you know, way back in the day before both of our times, there used to be an awful lot more tennis played on grass, didn't there? So, I mean, we're never going to go back to that, and nor should we. I don't think anyone's advocating for that necessarily, although I think a little bit more grass would be very welcome. I think that the goalposts have definitely moved in the last 5 to 10 years, largely because of Roger Federer. You know, Jim Courier was retired at 28, wasn't he? And yes, that was a bit young at the time, but it wasn't shock horror. So the goalposts have definitely changed, but you would expect them to change with the advancements in training and physiotherapy and all of the bells and whistles that come with being a rich, successful athlete now, gluten-free diets and the like of it. So it's a very knotty issue. I don't know enough about sort of the composition of hard courts to know whether there's Nadal seemed to be suggesting that there was a way of sort of keeping hard courts but making them less hard, which obviously sounds ridiculous now I'm saying it out loud, but something a bit sort of springier or softer.
Yeah, I mean, they're very grippy, aren't they?
Yes, gritty. That's the word.
What happens? It's one of those that I don't think we're going to get an answer to in the short term at all. But I sort of felt Nadal's mortality.
Oh, it was really quite poignant and depressing. He doesn't hold his emotions back. Does you can see it? It's writ large on his face. And he was down. He was really, really down. He was down after the win over Khachanov, which was an absolute triumph of mind over matter. And then the next day when he came to press, having just withdrawn from the semi-final with Federer, he was depressed about the whole situation. He even talked about feeling unlucky relative to his rivals, I think, that he keeps being frustrated by this issue and that his body isn't built for the surface on which the majority of tennis is played. It was a tough and poignant watch, and he's now missing Miami, and we'll next see him in Monte Carlo, fingers crossed.
Yeah, we only briefly saw Novak Djokovic after our last recording because we were all waiting for Kyrgios against Djokovic and laughing about the fact that Kyrgios had gone and lost in the first round to Filip Kohlschreiber, who was amazing, and then went and backed it up and beat Djokovic. And I think Djokovic, as brilliant as Kohlschreiber was, I think Djokovic was probably a little bit underdone out there. After 6 weeks without playing, and he ended up playing doubles pretty much all the way through the tournament, and I certainly don't have any fears for the form of Djokovic in the short, medium or long term based on that one defeat.
No, nor do I. I mean, I do think there's quite a lot of pressure on him in Miami now to not lose early, not necessarily to definitely go out and win the thing, although he is, I think, my favourite to do that. 42 days is a little bit too long, you know, certainly too long to be able to sort of come back and click right into gear. So, yeah, I mean, it was one of those really irritable, flat Djokovic performances that for a short period, a year, 18 months ago, we'd got quite used to seeing, hadn't we? And then suddenly they were erased from our mind, and it was machine-like Djokovic again. So I think this was a brief reversion to what we were seeing 18 months or so ago. But no cause for concern at all. As I say, he's my favourite to go on and win. in Miami, where Marion Vida will be back in the team. I don't understand the decision not to have Marion Vida with him in Indian Wells. His brother, his younger brother Marco, was with him here. But, you know, all of his major successes have come when Marion Vida is there. You know, I'm not sure there's ever been such a strong correlation between success and coach presence. No. Than with those two.
No, it's right up there. Maybe Marion Vida felt he needed to be at home. Who knows? But yeah, an interesting one. And also interesting is that Djokovic has drawn the winner of Bernard Tomic and Thomas Burdick in the first round. In his first match, that he gets a bye through the first round. So launched straight into battle. Put it that way. One of the conversations that also took place around Nadal, Catherine, was the fact that we got a pretty late-on decision from Nadal that he wasn't going to be able to play. It meant that people didn't get a second match after Thiem had played against Raonic. We'd also had a similar situation a couple of days earlier with Gael Monfils, who'd been playing absolutely magnificently, being unable to play in his match. And in fact, I think they lost an entire session, didn't they, as a result of that. And again, Chris Clary of the New York Times, just wondering whether maybe it's time to bring in some sort of rule, almost like a lucky loser rule for the later rounds, whereby if a player, having won, is unable to take his place in the next round, that the guy he beat goes through so that the crowd still has a match. I mean, it is really unsatisfactory to have a huge crowd waiting to see a big semi-final and a massive TV audience and radio audience unable to have anything to watch or listen to. Because if you consider that ABC in America, which is, you know, it's terrestrial television, had the rights to what to those semi-finals, and they had no match, no second match, and that is a massive blow for the sport as much as anything else. What's your view?
Yeah, my view is exactly as you've described. It's so catastrophic, a withdrawal and a cancellation of a match, particularly at that stage of a tournament, that it needs to be looked into. It deserves some looking at, and I don't see any fundamental reason why the main draw should be any different to qualifying. Everyone accepts the lucky loser rule and situation in qualifying, and yes, there have been some very welcome adjustments to it recently to prevent retirements, first round retirements, to prevent injured players taking to the court, and I think those have worked really well. I don't see any reason why we couldn't have the same situation. Yes, it would require some quite finessed rules in terms of points and prize money, because you wouldn't want to deny the withdrawing player the points that they've earned, the points and prize money they've earned for winning the previous match. So maybe, you know, in this situation, Khachanov would only pick up extra points and prize money if he then went on to win the semi-final and reach the final, if that makes sense. So essentially they're coming in and just playing that match. They don't get anything extra, but they're obviously playing for the chance to go on and get more and potentially win the tournament. For me, I'm sure there are downsides that aren't quite occurring to me, but I don't know.
There's a couple coming on social media here from AJG says, if you're not capable of beating an injured opponent, you shouldn't be given a second chance to win the tournament. Rosie Not the Dog says, I think the planned emergency exhibition match is the right thing to do. That's what they had with Djokovic and Sampras taking to the court with John McEnroe and Tommy Haas. That seemed to go down pretty well. So well done those four, by the way, for stepping up. Vicky Spreadbury says, this is really complicated. Yes, if you had to cancel a final for injury, that's awful. But if you were the other losing semi-finalist and your fellow loser was then advanced to the final one, you'd be pretty annoyed. And how would the points work? And how would the prize money work? And there's also some people that have pointed out that there might be an integrity issue here with the potential for fixing.
Yes, and I do. Yes, I accept that is potential, very big spanner in the works. That, and I wouldn't want to introduce a rule that could potentially sacrifice any integrity of the sport. So, yeah, I accept that. I don't have all the answers, but I think it's a big enough deal. It's a big enough deal that we need to look at it and not just say, oh, that'll never happen.
Well, I definitely agree with you. No, I definitely agree with you about that. Other talking points over the last week, there has been a Justin Gimelstob update. He has been into court again, and Josh Boswell of The Telegraph was there reporting for The Telegraph. And it's going to trial, by the sounds of things. A preliminary hearing is scheduled for April the 8th, and Gimelstob will be confronted with statements from witnesses of the alleged attack, as well as a video that the alleged victim's wife filmed of the assault. And the gentleman, Randall Kaplan, who is accusing Gimelstob of this attack, says that I'm extremely pleased at the result today. I've always wanted a trial, and I look forward to some of the more than 20 witnesses to the attack testifying. So pretty significant moment, certainly in terms of that case, and who knows what it'll end up leading to, but we'll let you know once we start to hear some of the details, further details coming out. But to remind you, Justin Gimelstob was one of the three members of the ATP player board who have voted that Chris Kermode is no longer to continue it and after the end of this year in the role of president and chairman of the ATP. And we were saying a week ago that wouldn't it be nice to at least hear from the players as to why they've made this decision, or hear, and we'd had no statement, we've heard nothing from the ATP player board. Well, since then, the ATP player board, Justin Gimelstob, Alex Inglot and David Egders have released a statement which has been widely circulated on social media. Frankly, it doesn't really say an awful lot as to why the decision was taken. What it mainly does is complain about the coverage that has been given to this situation. It sounds exasperated that we've all taken such an interest in what, in their words, is just an internal governance issue. It talks about all the hours that the player council members have put into it and how they've done it of their own free will. And so, yeah, I don't really understand why they've put out the statement, because it doesn't say an awful lot, in my opinion. It does reference that Chris Kermode had a strong 5 years, but then it's decided not to renew his contract, and it doesn't really offer any reasons as to why. So anyway, we don't know an awful lot more. I dare say over the next couple of weeks in Miami, where there will be more press conferences and more interviews conducted, I dare say more answers maybe will be forthcoming. But yeah, so that's the ATP player board politics. Now, one other news story that has come to all of our attentions over the last week, a really sad one, is the news that Paul Hutchins, the former Great Britain Davis Cup captain who led Britain to the 1978 Davis Cup final, has died of motor neurone disease. And it's something that he'd been suffering with for a few months. He is somebody that I've known for more than 20 years, had the pleasure of knowing, and he was incredibly helpful to me in my early years when I didn't know anybody in tennis at all, and I was writing letters off blindly to anybody who would be good enough to read them. He was one of the ones that did and wrote back, offered me some advice about how to get into the sport, and whenever I've had any dealings with him at all, he's been an absolute gentleman. Haven't heard a bad word said about this man in all the years that I've known him. And some of the tributes that have come in for him from Billie Jean King here, Paul Hutchins was a great champion on and off the court. Alison Risk, a current tour player on the women's circuit, said, "So terribly sad. Paul was part of my British family, always inviting me for a hit with him at Wimbledon. He quietly cheered for me everywhere I was and was always generous with his time and support." Leon Smith, the current Great Britain Davis captain, said, "The passing of Paul Hutchins is very saddening. He was a friend, colleague and mentor to many of us, a role model in every possible way. He had the strongest family values, treated friends with warmth and loyalty, and was the greatest Davis Cup captain we have ever had." I mean, those are just a few of countless tributes that have been paid to Paul Hutchins, including many from our media colleagues who again, just had a fantastic relationship with him, because he was happy to talk to us. He was happy to let us in on things. He once or twice asked people in the media not to report things that they might have seen or heard, because he was asking a favour, and that rare thing happened where they actually would agree to it because of the type of fella that he was. I know you, Catherine, you didn't know him, but you were there at the lawn tennis writers lunch that we had in December when Paul was there, and he gave a speech upon receiving a services to British Tennis Award. And it was an incredible moment, wasn't it? The speech he gave and the reaction that he received to that speech.
Yeah, it was. Talk about a moment to unite a room. It was extraordinarily poignant, even more so now in light of his death. His son Ross was there holding the microphone for him and helping him with the practicalities of giving the speech. But it was also enormously uplifting, incredibly uplifting, actually, what he had to say. It was, you know, the room was trying to pay tribute to him, and he was trying to pay tribute to the sport, which was incredibly powerful. And there wasn't anything trite at all about what he had to say. And I'm so... He was on our podcast in 2015, wasn't he, David? But that was an interview you did with him. I had never really met him, and I feel really, really grateful that I was at that lunch and I got to see him speak. And he undoubtedly will be hugely missed.
Yeah, no, he certainly will. And as you say, if you'd like to listen to that podcast that we did back with Paul Hutchins back in 2015, it was, I think, in May of 2015. And he talked all about the journey that he helped Britain along the road with to that Davis Cup final in 1978. Some wonderful memories of an early John McEnroe and just fantastic memories. I had to listen to it over the weekend just to remind myself, and really thrilled that he was on this show at one point, and that we will always have that. But yes, he'll be very, very sorely missed. So, Catherine, Miami starts next week. Your journey back from Indian Wells starts in a few hours.
In 1 hour. 1 hour.
In 1 hour.
Yes. It's a long journey because I have to get a car from here to Los Angeles, and due to LA traffic, what should be a sort of hour and a half journey as the crow flies, you have to allow four. So yes, right. A day full of first world problems for me.
Excellent. But it's been good, isn't it?
It's been great. It's been absolutely great. Yeah, I'm sold on Indian Wells. It's great.
Okay.
And I'm looking forward to going home.
Awesome. Right. Well, welcome back, Catherine. Get yourself back here and we'll get ourselves to the Putney Exchange or to the pub, and we'll record our next podcast in a week's time. We'll see if we can get Grad Matt Roberts back with us as well, get the old gang back together in person, and bring you another edition of the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by TennisBalls.com with our mascot, Rio with a Y. Don't forget to tell your mates about the Tennis Podcast. Everybody you know, all your Twitter followers, all your Facebook followers and whatnot, so that we can grow our audience. And we'll be back with another show next week. See you then.